Natalie, I guess let's start at the beginning with this and tell me how the idea for this book came about.
Well, I think there are many factors that came together. We went through a recession, and I think a lot of us have always been drinking wine on a budget. We don't have $100 to slap down for a bottle. So I thought at first, will I write about the world's greatest wines? Yeah, and all seven of us could get together for a book club and explore that book. Or will I, then my mind turned to, let's write about bargain wines, something that everyone can relate to. I think we have a budget, but we don't want to give up great taste. So it was the search for those kind of wines. Where are they and how can we find them?
I think that we all struggle with the price of wine at some point or another. Most of us do anyway. And it's difficult to put a value on something that's as ephemeral as what's in a bottle that can change from brand to brand, even from bottle to bottle of the same wine. So how do you go about explaining to us what goes into making a wine and what goes into making up the cost of a wine?
Well, there are certain cost factors, of course. So from how expensive is your vineyard land to did you use fancy French barrels to what kind of packaging and design. But I think there is a cutoff point, and call it $30, $50, whatever. And above that, you're paying for intangibles like rarity, a critic's score, collectability. You're paying for what other people want than for what you get. So I was looking in the sweet spot of $10 to $15, maybe $17 for wines that taste twice as expensive as they cost. So there are real cost factors that make it hard, in my opinion, to find a lot of wines under the $10 mark. But I think in that range, you can find lots that over-deliver from a variety of regions for different reasons.
Give me some of those reasons.
Sure. Okay, if we start with one insider tip to finding bargain wines is going to a less fashionable region of a country well-known for wine. So if you go to France, you go to southern France, like the Languedoc or Provence for their dry rosés. In Italy, instead of Piedmont and Tuscany, which are very expensive, go down to Sicily. And some of these winemaking regions in the southern parts of these countries have been making wine for hundreds of years, but they're revitalizing their image, they're, you know, modernizing their style, but they're offering amazing value. At the same time, twinned with that tip is go for less fashionable grapes. So Cabernet and Chardonnay, you're going to pay up. Those are brand name grapes wherever they're grown. But if you go with Sicily's Nero d'Avola, which is a mouthful to say, or even Chile's Carmenere instead of Merlot, you will pay less because not everybody is familiar with that, and they're trying to make inroads into the market as a result.
I think we try to go with what's familiar, but I saw one of your tips in there was, like, look for a really long and unpronounceable name on the label in an old-fashioned-looking label.
Exactly. Yeah. Poor Germany. Unless you speak German, of course. A few of us can read those long Gothic script names. But it's a way of, you know, if you can become familiar with some of those wines and just try them. You don't have to be able to take a course in German to just experiment with German Rieslings. They're amazing. And they're also recovering from a kind of a bad reputation 2-3 decades ago, that sweet syrupy stuff that we drank behind the high school portable. So for those combined reasons, German Rieslings are amazingly low priced. What I advise is go into the store, buy a mixed case, and just sample over time so you're not stressed out about finding the one perfect wine or did this work out. I think it's a great way to discover some terrific bargain wines.
Now, this book is, it's about searching for bargain wines, but it's also about the people. And, I know this from going to wineries, is that to me, because I'm not a wine writer per se, I love meeting these characters. And you've met some really great ones on these journeys, right?
Yes, absolutely. It is the search for bargain wines, but it's also the search for people passionate about making wine. Because I think if you find those colorful, obsessive, provocative people, in telling their story, you can tell the story of wine. And so that's what I did. So in Australia, I met up with Wolf Blass. He's not a brand character like Duncan Hines. He's real. And, no marketing team could ever invent him. He's just, a soundbite a minute. But, he challenges us to think about how we think about wine and Australian Shiraz. And he makes terrific wine at you know, very reasonable prices. But I think it's more interesting to talk about him and sort of learn about wine that way than just to sit down with, you know, 30 of his wines and give you the tasting notes, which would bore me personally.
I want to talk about Canadian wines a bit. And I mean, Canada makes some really good wines now, but also I'm going into our liquor stores, especially in British Columbia, and I'm seeing $30, $50 bottles of Canadian wine, and I know I can spend equal amount of money on an imported wine and get something that's as good as or quite a bit better. So how much does our kind of government structure lend us to having wines that what I think are too high in price?
Well, certainly, you know, the taxes we have on all of our wines, but including and especially our own wines, are a deterrent. The one thing, though, that I find about both the wines from the Okanagan and Niagara, especially the Pinot Noir and the Riesling, we make amazing wines, and they are bargains if you look at what are the benchmark wines in comparison to the old world. So if you take Pinot Noir, the heartbreak grape, it's difficult to grow. It's always expensive. It's not going to be cheap anywhere. Our Pinot Noirs are going to start at $20-$25 and go up. But if you look at Burgundy, France, for their Pinot Noir, you're going to pay double or triple even for a Pinot Noir from that region. So I think on that basis, I wasn't searching for the world's cheapest wines, but bargain meaning value, price to quality ratio. And I do think for the wines that we excel at, Pinot Noir and Riesling, and of course our dessert wines or ice wines, they are a bargain.
One of the tenets of my show that I do is that I like to talk about sustainable products. And I know that you came across some of those, and I know you talked to people about organic wines, a sustainable vineyard. How has that changed since you first started going into this business, and where is it going?
I think there are a lot more producers in the wine industry who are interested in organic and biodynamic farming. For multiple reasons, and it's not just sort of cynical marketing. In fact, a lot of the organic and biodynamic producers I met won't put it on the label, and because they're concerned that some consumers might still think that means the wine isn't going to keep or it's not as good, but that is changing. The other big reason why they want to produce these organic and biodynamic wines is that I think, of course, there's the environmental impact, which is obvious and important. But there's also the careful attention to the process that is required. And that's what you want in wine. You want someone paying attention to how are these vines going to thrive without a lot of chemical help. And to me, if someone is paying close attention to the process, to the way they're growing the vines, the way they're making the wine, because they're trying to achieve organic or biodynamic standards, that's going to result in increased quality. Like the odds are that it will.
Well, and that's the way it was done back in the beginning, right?
Exactly.
They didn't have the chemicals to put on the vines.
Exactly. I mean, it's the most natural way to go. And, you know, winemaking is fancied up farming. That's all it is, right? We think about the wine culture as being very glamorous. And, you know, yes, there's a label on the bottle, whereas maybe there isn't on a tomato. But still, when you get right down to it, winemaking is farming. And, you know, when they are getting into the principles of organic and biodynamic farming, I think that's a good thing.
Just to change directions a bit, I noticed that this book is available as an ebook, but also in the hard copy, you say, go to these places. There is so much more to this book than just what's sitting in my bag right now.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think this is a big difference from when my first book came out back in 2006. I mean, there's Twitter, there's Facebook, there's the web is such a strong presence now that we really tried to marry the book to my own website and other websites. So because my publisher isn't willing to publish the book monthly and the wines go in and out of the stores monthly, what I've done is direct people to the wine recommendations that I do weekly on my website at nataliemclean.com. But also other resources that are out there that can help you learn more about wines in other regions. And I think that's what's changing about the way we learn about wine. So yes, there's still a place for a book, but, you know, I mean, on Twitter alone, it's the wine channel. I just exchange wine recommendations with people all day. And I think people coming into the wine world and wanting to learn about wine, there's so many resources. And so that tight coupling between the old print world and the online world is a natural one.
It can be overwhelming. I mean, how do you keep up with it all? Because there's another new wine every day.
Yes.
New wine, one new wine every day? No, many new wines every day.
Exactly. That is why we have wine critics and not orange juice critics, because, you know, there are a million producers worldwide of wine. Their wines change every year, unlike a book you read 8 years ago. It's still going to be basically the same book. And each of them producing 5 to 20 different types of wines. The choice is overwhelming, but that's also what can make it exciting. And I think that's why people are gravitating toward online, because they want personal referrals. They don't want to stand in a liquor store and look at 1,000 bottles and think, do I like Castle in the Middle Distance, Fluffy Squirrel, whatever. They want to hear from somebody on Twitter, on Facebook, from a website. You know, narrow it down for me. Help me decide. Give me just a quick shopping list, which is what I try to do on my website, is like, here are 10 great wines to go with steak or roast chicken or whatever. Or, you know, here are the wines that you read about in the book that are just coming into the stores now. So go get them.
And photos and everything, though, from the book, or from the topic material, are online as opposed to being in the book.
Exactly. You know, a print book is a high production cost, so, you know, we weren't going to make a coffee table book with color photos, but there's a photo album online, and people can even comment on it. There are recipes just noted at the end of each chapter in that sort of special tips section that were contributed by the winery chefs. But those are online, too, because it just makes the book too big. So I think, again, you know, it's a perfect intersection of that old-fashioned print and newfangled online.
Do you ever get tired of tasting wines?
Oh, no. I
knew the answer to that.
I did a wrong job. No, it's great. I'm a thoroughly hedonistic researcher. I don't think I'll ever tire of it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Don.